This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 91, Chronic People Pleasers. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Drew Stewart. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the casting of Marina Sirtis on NCIS, the reunion of Kirk and the Gorn, the possibility of Netflix bringing Enterprise back for a fifth season, IDW's comic sequel After Darkness, and the May issue of Empire magazine with its fold-out Into Darkness cover. Oh, and we also come to terms with the fact that Leffler won't be making us obey her laws after all. Then in the feature, we're joined by Kate Walsh and John Champion to discuss the classic TOS episode, This Side of Paradise. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Drew. How are you today?
I'm doing really good. Like, this morning, it was really gray and disgusting. And, you know, we went to church, and on the way back, it was still gray and disgusting, and we decided we were going to get our motorcycles out and suffer through because, you know, we can start using them again tomorrow, according to insurance. So we rode them in the, you know, the rain, mist, and it was all gross. And then within an hour, it was beautiful outside. So apparently spring is here.
Spring is here. You mentioned church, which reminds me we are recording this episode on Easter. And, you know, every year when Easter rolls around, it just makes me wish that I had an opportunity to do an Easter egg hunt aboard the Enterprise.
But that, remember that episode, right? Where they did that?
I don't know. We're doing TOS this week. They didn't have a TOS Easter episode, did they?
No, I'm pretty sure the Next Generation did, didn't they? Something about they're having an Easter egg hunt, but they couldn't find them all.
That's right. That's
they couldn't
right.
find them all, and then nobody can go in the Jeffrey's tube because the eggs were going bad.
That's right. I remember that episode now. You know, actually, I think we have a synopsis of that episode. Shall we do a dramatic reading?
Let's.
You know, many Star Trek fans may think that the fact that there was never an Easter episode of Star Trek with an egg hunt on the Enterprise was a major missed opportunity. But what they forget is that the Next Generation did it. And here's what happened.
The problem that they had was that they were so well hidden. Geordi put so many in the Jeffrey's tubes that they couldn't find them all, and the smell was getting absurd.
And then Wesley had to build an egg detector with integrated tractor beam for egg retrieval. Of course, it's a school project.
Unfortunately, that integrated tractor beam knocked the warp field out of alignment, so they were stuck in a bad section of Cardassian space.
Oh, of course, and that's when Geordi had to go on a date with holographic Leia Brahms to figure out how to get the warp field working again.
The warp field fluctuations knocked out an elevator, so Riker's stuck with the only crew member who doesn't find him irresistible.
But nevertheless, he still props his leg up on the control panel and inadvertently hits a button that starts the backup warp core.
Unfortunately, the backup warp core is so forgotten that it's actually haunted by alien ghosts that got picked up by the Bassard collectors. The issue is only Beverly can see them.
And then it turns out that one of them was her grandmother's lover.
Unfortunately, she can only see them, so she has to meet with Troy to figure out how they're feeling, but Picard is still unconvinced that there are ghosts at all.
That's when Picard orders Data to monitor the ship, and they discover that the ghosts are actually the spirits of the Enterprise crew.
Fortunately, Data's ghost can communicate with him, and they're able to avoid the gravitic mine that they were about to hit.
So the day is saved, and then they all go to 10 Forward, where Troy shows them the proper way to eat a chocolate bunny. Laughter ensues, and the Enterprise sails off into the distance. Fade to black. That was a great episode. How did I forget that episode, Drew?
I don't know. My favorite part was Troy. Like, I sense hunger and sugar. I don't understand it.
Yeah, Troy has a one-track mind, and it's all on chocolate. So Easter has to be her favorite holiday.
I think it was because Troy's ghost was talking to her.
Maybe that's what it was. All right, so happy Easter to everyone. Drew, let's jump into news. And unfortunately, and we just did this, I think, 2 weeks ago, we have to start news off with a sad note that we have lost another member of the Star Trek family. And this is James Meese. He was a set decorator who worked on The Next Generation, Voyager, and Enterprise. And fans will, of course, know his work when they see it. He helped create Picard's Ready Room. He also created that fantastic bookstore in the Voyager episode 1159.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail to every episode that I think that rewatches really show you. And now in HD, you can really see the details, the props. There's so many, you know, every book on a shelf was placed there by someone. Every pen that's sitting there, like when they go to the holodeck, and I'm thinking of when Data is Sherlock Holmes. Like, there's so many little references to Sherlock Holmes in that somebody had to find it and put it together and make it and then put it there and put this lamp here. And you know, if this lamp was over here, then it would distract the eye from the characters. And there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And I'm pretty sure that James had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, those are the details that people like James Meese are the unsung heroes of Star Trek. You know, it's easy to focus on the actors, of course, and on the writers and on the directors. But the people that do these small touches of set decor are so critical to the look and the feel of the show, giving us that sense of realism that helps to pull us into the stories. And it's amazing all the work that he did on the show for so many years. He passed away on March 29th at the very young age of 57, which is really sad because, you know, there would have been so much more that he could have done over the years. But we really appreciate all of his contributions. He started his career off working on the Lawrence Welk show, which, Drew, I don't know, you're a little bit younger than me. Did you watch the Lawrence Welk show when you were a kid?
This is probably the second time I've ever heard the words Lawrence Welk.
Okay. So for me, I did in my great-grandparents' house, every week, Lawrence Welk was on the television. It was a music show. And
oh, cool.
And I can still in my mind see the set decor right now. And that's where James Meese got his start. He went on to work on a lot of shows that I'm sure you do know. The Jeffersons, Sanford, One Day at a Time, and Who's the Boss? And then he worked on TNG, Voyager, and Enterprise. He was nominated for 5 Emmys along with the crew of the Star Trek series. And he shared an Emmy in 1990 for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Art Design for a Series with Richard D. James for the episode. And you know this one, Sins of the Father, which is in fact one of the episodes that they chose for the Blu-ray sampler when they first started the TNG Remastered. Because it was such a great piece with which to test out the various approaches to lighting and textures and such that they would need to do the project.
Now, I'm not seeing it in his bio, but did he not work on Bosom Buddies?
I bet it's in there somewhere because, you know, all the great creatives in some way can be traced back to Bosom Buddies. Absolutely. So it's very sad to see James pass away at such a young age. But on behalf of all Star Trek fans, we want to say thank you for his contributions. And we also want to direct you to StarTrek.com. They have a 2-part archival video interview with James Meese on the site there, and we'll put links to those in the show notes over at trek.fm/TRR91. Drew, last week we wished a happy 82nd birthday to William Shatner, and I feel like it's a repeat this week. It's happy 82nd birthday to Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, it's really great. Like, it's, I mean, I don't want to be too happy. I mean, because we just talked about someone who died young, but it's really great to see these classic actors from the original series still kicking it, still acting, still following their passions. Nimoy with his photography now, Shatner with his commercials. But I mean, for 82 years old, you know, to be running around and doing all the stuff that they do, it's inspiring. It makes you think. I mean, I'm only 29 years old, and sometimes I feel like, oh, you know, I'm going to be 30 next year. The world's going to end. I mean, Nimoy's 52 years older than me. Like, I don't even think he'd started Star Trek by the time that he was my age. And he's had so much of his life after that point. And it's really inspiring to see older people still kicking it. And it's awesome.
That's right. Just like Leonard here, when you are, what was that, 2 years ago, when you're about 80, you can be in the music video for Bruno Mars III. You know, it's Bruno Mars's kid's kid. He's going to be a big time singer. He's going to come and get you, Drew, to be in his video for the Lazier song.
I can only dream.
Just like, of course, everyone remembers, I hope, Star Trek fans saw Leonard Nimoy in Bruno Mars's video for the Lazy song a couple of years ago. You know, tracing back his post-Star Trek career, he, of course, played the IMF agent Paris, who was the ex-magician and makeup expert on Mission Impossible during the fourth and fifth seasons. And then, you know, he didn't have as much TV work. He wasn't as much in the public eye as William Shatner has been post-Star Trek. But he's done fantastic creative work in his love for photography. He studied photography at UCLA after Star Trek and Mission Impossible. And he actually has a place up at Lake Tahoe. Now, my aunt and uncle live at Lake Tahoe, and they often see Leonard Nimoy in the supermarket down the street from their house.
Wow.
Over the years, because, you know, I mean, he's just there, he's relaxing, he does his photography, he's an ordinary guy, and he has to go shopping, he needs to get food, and that's always a story that I love.
I'm disappointed that he didn't keep on with his music career like Shatner did. I mean, because Nimoy would at least try to sing. I mean, Shatner is great with his spoken word stuff. I really, really love it.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to hear what other kind of classics we could have got beyond The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins, which I'm disappointed did not run during the credits of the movie. Maybe they're saving it for the last one. I don't know. We'll find out.
Maybe so. Maybe he can get together with Ben Folds and record another album, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I am not Spock. Oh, yes, I am. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yes, I am.
Maybe I'm not. With a guest appearance by Zachary Quinto, of course. Can Zachary sing? I don't know. I haven't heard him.
I don't know. I'm sure he can. He seems like one of those guys that can do everything. Recent Star Trek fans may know Leonard Nimoy from the most recent J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, where he played old Spock.
That's
just right. In case. I don't know. I don't know what kind of audience we may have during the news here. I never listen, so I don't know.
Right, because you only listen to the show when you're on it, and you're usually
exactly.
Only in the feature. So, all right. So, happy birthday, Leonard Nimoy. Thank you for all your work on Star Trek and everything else over the years, and bringing us definitely one of the most beloved characters, I think, in all of pop culture or any kind of fiction. Period.
Everybody knows Mr. Spock.
Drew, changing subjects here, it's another sad note. We're flip-flopping. Mm. Sad, happy, sad. I was happy a couple of weeks ago when I thought that I was going to be forced by rule of law to obey Loeffler's laws as Ashley Judd was entertaining a run for the U.S. Senate in the state of Kentucky. And I was going to be, you know, pretty much perfectly happy to do anything Loeffler told me to do. Well, it turns out that Loeffler is not going to be Senator Loeffler after all.
That is disappointing. I think I actually found this article, or the article that you guys talked about a few weeks ago, on my own outside of you guys. And I'm just like, Ashley Judd running for Ashley Judd. Wait a minute. Like, I'm assuming that this is going to be on the news and on the
that's right.
Ready Room. And
it's,
I was absolutely
it's
right.
Loeffler. It's got to be on the news. Anyone who follows me on Twitter knows every day Tristan Riddell, international sex symbol Tristan Riddell, the insane Robin, does the Star Trek question of the day. Shortly after, I give him my Loeffler answer of the day, because it doesn't matter what he asks, I will find a way to insert Loeffler into the answer.
He'll try to throw you curveballs, but you always manage to at least hit a grounder or some other sports metaphor. The ball is right. Not a strike.
Got to get some sports ball in there.
Strikes are bad.
That's right. You know, yeah, I think maybe Ashley's a little bit too sweet, you know, to really change Congress the way it needs to be changed. I think Jeffrey Combs should run for Senate, because then, you know, when there's a disagreement where they just can't, the two sides can't come together, he can jump in there. What they need is a big Andorian fight scene.
How do you give up? Never!
When that Andorian comes in there to kick some ass, you know, they can come together, they can just put their differences aside, mm-hmm. Make those kind of compromises they need to make, because, you know, if you don't, well, more Andorians are going to show up. That's what will change the U.S. Congress.
I assumed you were going to go with the, if you put Jeffrey Combs somewhere, eventually he will be all of the people in that area.
That's true.
And so then they'd be able to agree on things, because they'd all be Jeffrey Combs.
They'll come in and they'll go, and now the Speaker of the House, and it's Jeffrey Combs. And then he calls, yes, representative from the great state of California. And they cut over on C-SPAN, and it's Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
He's everywhere.
What's great is that I keep pointing him out to my wife, like, look, listen, it's Jeffrey Combs in this episode, you know, here on Enterprise and stuff. And she's like, which one's Jeffrey Combs? And I was like, well, because we're not deep into Deep Space Nine yet. She only remembers him as the creepy guy who wants to make a holographic version of Kira. So we've only dipped our toe in Jeffrey Combs so far.
Yeah, and he has two characters, right, on Deep Space Nine. So
he's Wayun Brunt and the creepy guy.
And the creepy guy, so that's three. Have you guys watched the 4400 yet?
No. Is he everywhere in that, too?
Yeah, he became a regular cast member on the 4400. He plays Dr. Kevin Burkhoff, who is very instrumental in the storyline. And he's not wearing any prosthetic makeup or anything. But brilliant performance, classic Jeffrey Combs. So if you... And 4400 is Ira Stephen Bear's show, post-Deep Space Nine. So if you like DS9, definitely, and you haven't seen the 4400, check out that show. It's quite interesting. He does not play Shran on that show.
Oh, well, maybe not, but...
All right. So too bad, no Loeffler's laws. But if she wants to come personally, tell me her laws, you know where to find
me. We'd be glad to have her.
In her N7 hoodie. So anyway, let's move on to other cast news. We have a lot of cast news this week. Marina Sirtis fans, and there are a lot of them out there, will be happy to know that she has been cast as a regular cast member in NCIS. And another birthday, happy birthday wishes to Marina, who turns amazingly 58, and she looks fantastic at 58.
Wow. Yeah, I'm glad that she's still around, and she's still able to get roles like this. I don't watch NCIS. I work near NCIS for reals, but I've not actually seen the show, but I think that's really good that she's still getting roles. Not that she's at an advanced age, but it's really good to see. I like seeing Trek actors outside of being able to move beyond the convention circuit and back into television.
Yeah, back into television. Okay, so you work near NCIS. I have to ask you a question. Now, I know that you have trouble downloading our podcasts because mm-hmm. the part of the military that you work for blocks various sites, including Trek FM, and at least to get our audio files. Now, does NCIS also block us? And are you not allowed to use your iPhone if you go over to the NCIS area?
I don't know. I've not been in there. I don't want to instigate anything, but I'm in my low clearance building. I'm not allowed to have my phone, so I imagine that they're pretty secure in there. And I'm sure if I watched NCIS, I'd be like, there'd be no way that they could do that. They wouldn't be allowed to do that. You can't answer your phone there. You have to have a government BlackBerry in order to do that.
Oh, my. So the role that Marina Sirtis is going to have on NCIS, she's going to be playing Orly Elbaz, the head of the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad. And her first episode is going to be airing in April. And Gary Glassberg, who's the showrunner of NCIS, said about Marina, she's everything I wanted for the role, and then some, we are lucky to have her. Which is coincidentally the same thing that Riker said about her when asked why she is his Imzadi. All right, so also, if you'd like to see Marina in person, if you're heading out to the Sun City Sci-Fi Con in El Paso, she's going to be there April 26th through 28th. And if you'd like to see more of her online, go over to friend of the show, Larry Nemechek's Trekland blog, where he has a video interview from 2009 that he did with Marina. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
And now, finally, the rematch we've all been waiting for. Ever since Cestus 3, we've been waiting for this reuniting of Kirk versus the Gorn. And here, finally, 45, 46 years later, we finally get it in a commercial for the Star Trek JJ Star Trek game. And if you haven't seen this commercial, you need to stop whatever you're doing. I don't care if you're driving or flying. I don't care. Stop what you're doing. Pull over. Get your cell phone out. Find this video and watch it, because it's incredible.
Yes. Kirk and the Gorn, Shatner and the Gorn, they have been reunited, and it feels so good. And yes, Drew, I do think that is the official name of the game. It's Star Trek, the JJ Star Trek... video game.
Star Trek JJ Star Trek video game.
Trek. On the package. It was a typesetting challenge for the people at Namco Bandai, but they got it all on there. So yeah, this commercial is fantastic, and it shows what a great sense of humor William Shatner has. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that both Shatner and the Gorn are older now. And as they get into their fight, they get a little winded. And they just can't, you know, they have to take breaks during the fight.
but the hits, the pacing of the attacks are perfect. Perfect. I'm sure that you could sync it. Just the slow double baseball bat hit, huh. And then the ear clap, ha. Huh. Which I love seeing awesome. In the game that you can ear slap a Gorn as Pinekirk.
Which I'm going to totally be doing that
all the time, every time.
I love, too, the slow motion nature of the moves in this commercial. You could pin it to them being kind of old now, but actually the speed is just spot on accurate to the actual fight in arena.
That's the actual choreography. That's why it's the greatest fight ever put on television.
It really is. I think my favorite part of this commercial, though, is when the Gorn picks up a pillow to throw at Shatner. Because, you know, that pillow is just as soft as that boulder was that he was going to throw at Kirk in the episode Arena.
I do like that Shatner, he begged and begged and begged and begged to be in the movie. And then he denied wanting to be in the movie. In JJ's movie, it's nice to see that they were able to get him not only to reenact the Gorn fight, but to at least pretend to play a video game based on the movie he was shut out from. Watching Shatner play Pine, playing Shatner playing Kirk is interesting. There's a lot of levels there that you may not get on the first viewing.
And on the same token, I thought it was great that he brought Chris Pine in on the Captain's documentary that he did, because he could have easily just omitted Chris Pine, because, you know, I mean, it was about captains of the series, and at that point, Pine had just done this one movie. But yeah, I think Shatner's been very classy about this whole Abrams thing, personally. Now, Drew, I pre-ordered this video game when it was first made available for pre-order. Now, are you a gamer yourself, Drew?
I am, and I'm really into co-op games. My wife and I, we don't play games unless we can play it together most of the time. Well, we get single-player games, and then we'll play them and then never play them again. But co-op games, we'll keep coming back to it. And so I was excited when they announced it. I'm still going to wait for some reviews, because $60 is a lot to pour into a movie tie-in game. But I'm hoping that the gameplay is solid, that the voice acting is solid, and that the plot is actually relevant to the movies, and not just a, you know, oh, look, the Gorn. So I'm holding off. I know that I'm not going to get any of the fancy outfits, but I would only pick the... Unless one of these is the original series outfit, which it doesn't look like there are.
I think I'm
good just waiting. But if one of them... Yes, if... Listen. If one of you stores makes one of the exclusives... an original series outfit, then I will pre-order this game.
Great.
From you.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So we'll have to play this together, because you can play as Kirk and Spock, and it is a co-op game. And so I know sooner or later, I mean, you're waiting for reviews, but come on, admit it, Drew. You're going to buy the game.
Oh, I'm definitely going to buy it eventually.
You're going to buy it. So we'll have to play this
together.
But
I'm
going to
buy it
on
the Xbox, so... I don't know if we can play it together.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Now, do we have to both be on PS3 or both on Xbox to play
together?
Sure.
I guess
we
probably do, don't we? They've not done cross.
Right. Well, I'll go order an Xbox. You know, I get them really cheap here in Japan because they're extremely unpopular here. They basically have to give them away. Seriously, Xbox is a complete flop in Japan, so I can get... They'll probably give me one, like a buy some batteries or something.
You buy the game, you buy the Star Trek, JJ Star Trek game, the game, and then you get an Xbox for free.
It comes, yeah. It's like sometimes they bundle the console with a new game that's coming out, especially handhelds. This is the other way around. You buy the game and the console comes bundled with it.
I've done that.
All right. So if you do want a pre-order, though, you can get a number of extras. You get what's called the Elite Officer Pack, and that includes five other packs. The Stealth Pack, which gives Kirk and Spock stealth uniforms and Starfleet Type 4 stealth sniper rifles and extra ammo, because you can never have enough ammo when you're going to be fighting the Gorn. There's also the Brawler Pack, which gives Kirk a leather jacket and Spock of Vulcan Science Academy uniform. So Kirk's going to get the kick-ass leather jacket, and Spock's going to be the nerd. That's basically what you get in that pack.
Yeah, that's how it'll work.
Yeah. There's the Kelvin pack, where Kirk and Spock get USS Kelvin uniforms, which is interesting since Kirk was born as the Kelvin was being destroyed and Spock never was on the ship, but you can dress them up anyway. You get the USS Kelvin hand phaser. You also get the Academy pack, Kirk Academy uniform, Spock officer dress uniform, and an Academy phaser, which I find interesting. Does that mean that you're allowed to just carry firearms around in Starfleet Academy? Do you, like, go
was
to class
different...
with the phaser?
Did I miss something? Is there a different class of phaser that they use at the Academy?
I guess. I think it shoots BBs. That's what it is.
Oh. Oh, it's like got a big orange tip on the end?
Yeah.
So that you know it's not a real phaser?
It's Nerf, actually. It shoots like little Nerf darts. Oh, that's what it is.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then lastly, there's the Kobayashi Maru pack, which gives Kirk and Spock Kobayashi Maru uniforms. And I hope, and it doesn't say this, but I hope an apple, because you got to eat the apple during the Kobayashi
An apple
Maru.
Gives you, it gives Kirk a power up when he takes a bite out of it.
That's right. It's a power up. Exactly. It's like Pac-Man on like the third level where you get the apple. All right. Well, it's currently $59.99 if you want to pre-order. The price might come down around release date. That sometimes happens. It's available April 26th. That's what I see for most places, although Amazon shows it as being April 23rd. And if you want to watch this fantastic Shatner Gorn commercial, we'll put a link in the show notes, or you can tap the screen in the enhanced and open it up in your YouTube app. Drew, let's move into some news about the most recent Star Trek television series, that being Enterprise. Now, you're currently watching Enterprise for the first time, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm watching a lot of Trek for the first time, as you mock me incessantly about. but right now, I'm in an Enterprise kick. I'm really enjoying it. And I was really excited to see this news that after Veronica Mars got a movie through Kickstarter, raised like $2.5 million in 3 hours or something ridiculous, it was brought to Brandon Braga, would you make an Enterprise series if we crowdfunded it? And he said that he didn't think so, but then he came back later saying that there's always a possibility through Netflix, like Arrested Development coming back for a fourth season, and Brandon Braga is now saying that perhaps we could have a fifth season of Enterprise on Netflix.
Right, yeah. He originally dismissed it as being implausible. And I can see that. I think a fundraiser like this to do something like a fifth season of Enterprise is more about showing a studio, you know, it's not going to be CBS, I'm sure, in this case, showing a studio that there's enough fan interest there to take on the project, because you're not going to raise enough money that way to actually make even one episode of a show like Enterprise. But it's kind of a show of interest. And TrekCore did an interview with Brannon at Star Trek London, and they've put it on their website. There's actually a two-part video interview. And in one of those, they did ask him about this. And so he seems to think, maybe Netflix could be the home of that, because you mentioned Arrested Development. Yeah, it's things like that where, you know, I've heard some speculation actually on other tech podcasts about how, you know, maybe Netflix is becoming one of those new networks. There's, you know, the companies that we see as tech companies now, you know, like Google, Netflix here, could become like the ABC, the NBC, the CBS of the past in the future. And maybe that's where we're headed. Because at first glance, you think, well, Netflix bringing back a show like Enterprise, you know, maybe sci-fi in the past we've kind of thought might be plausible, but not Netflix. So who knows? But I don't know. I mean, you haven't gotten to the end of Enterprise yet, but from what you've seen so far, would you be interested in seeing a fifth season of a show that ended almost 10 years ago?
Well, I've seen the last episode, supposedly. I've blocked most of it out of my mind.
Yes.
But if I recall correctly, that episode did flash forward a few years.
It did, yes.
And I'm thinking that maybe they could pick up at that point if certain events didn't happen.
Yeah.
you know, because it was just a holographic recreation or something, they could still be out there. At this point, I don't see Bakula taking the captain's chair again, right. 10 years on.
Yeah.
I imagine that will be, you know, cameos, like he'll be the president of the Federation and he'll be sending people off on the missions. And there's a new, the cool upgraded Enterprise NX-01 that Drexler made with mm-hmm. the secondary hull. I can imagine them taking the refit out, you know, a new captain, some of the old crew maybe still around. Kind of an Enterprise Next Generation, I guess.
Ooh. Yeah, see, it's tough for me. It's like, I was really disappointed that the show ended. It was really starting to get really good in the fourth season and be that prequel that I think most fans wanted. And I think when most fans think about the fifth season, what they want to see is the Romulan War. But the Romulan War has been played out, and it actually currently still is being played out in the novels. And I don't know if they would revisit that or not. But I think the bigger obstacle is the cast, because so much time has passed bringing all of those characters back, and the fact that the actors have aged quite a bit since the time the show was on. It definitely would have to be, like you say, a flash forward scenario where they are jumping into the future so that we feel that it makes sense. It wouldn't be like the TOS movies where we had such a long time that we were able in our minds to completely separate the original series from the movies. It wouldn't be like that. It would be more like, here's a continuation of the show, but hey, look, the actors look quite a bit different now mm-hmm. than they did. And here's Porthos the Fifth, and you know, who's on there. So I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting idea. I guess if they do it, I'll watch it. We do have some followers on Twitter who are really gung-ho about it. They tweet us all the time about trying to get us to really vocally support a fifth season of Enterprise. And it's something that I don't do just because creatively I feel like, even though I don't like the way the series ended, it did end. And I don't really want to go back there now.
Yeah.
With this much separation.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Even though I love Enterprise series, yeah, I like the exploration, the unknown, the we're far from home and we can't just turn around and be home tomorrow. Right. I love that about Enterprise, but I don't see how we could go back to that story 10 years later. It would be a different show, and at that point, you might as well make a different show. I don't know when in history to place it, and at this point I think that they would go with something in the JJ verse, maybe a JJ verse version of Enterprise.
Huh, that could be interesting too.
With a recast Archer, a recast Mayweather who actually gets to do things.
And then he gets to do that's the difference. Yes, Abrams verse Travis Mayweather, he like runs the whole ship. Without him, yes, the ship would just fall apart. That'd be perfect. All right. Well, we'll see what happens on that. Anyway, we'll put links in the show notes to the Trek Core Brandon Braga interviews. And also Trek Movie has an article about this, which we'll link up here in the Enhanced podcast if you want to click through and read a little bit more there. Drew, let's take a moment here out of news to tell folks about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the easiest way to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now you can even do an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. I've been a Squarespace user for 5 or 6 years now. I use it not only for Trek FM, but I use it for my personal blog. I use it for client projects as well. It's an all-in-one platform. Hosting and CMS makes my life incredibly easy as a designer and as a communications professional. And also, it makes Trek FM so easy for me to do as well.
Yeah, I like being able to log in and not having to go to kind of a behind-the-scenes control panel thing in order to change the header or anything like that. Everything is just, you click on it and it's like, okay, change it. And it changes it live and saves it. There's no, you know, like, where do I do that? You know, because I'm working, my wife is opening a business and we're trying to make Blogger work for her for now until she starts generating some revenue. And then we're going to look into Squarespace and get her some commerce going and generate even more revenue. We're excited about that. But it's just, it's like, okay, well, where do we put the thing? We want the thing on the sidebar. Is that in template? Is that in gadgets? Is that in, it's hard to figure it out. But with Squarespace, it's all just right there. You want to put something there, you click over there and it puts it there. It's very easy to use.
It's very easy, yeah, being all inline. You know, for years, I have built websites in Dreamweaver and even other tools before that, because I started building websites professionally back in probably 1995, I think, was maybe my first one. So I've been used to those very complex tools. And then, like you say, with online things like Blogger or WordPress, which I do have to use for a few clients, there's all that behind the scenes stuff that you have to deal with, and you have to manage plugins, and you have to keep updating things, and you have to update individual plugins from different makers. It becomes quite cumbersome. Squarespace just removes all of that. So you can just focus on making a beautiful blog, a beautiful website, focus on your content, because that's really what you want to get out to people. And they make it really easy for you to share that content through their social media integration as well. We've talked a lot about all of these things on recent shows. One thing that we haven't gotten to talk about too much that I wanted to focus on today is the role of contributors in site management. Because if you're doing a personal blog and it's just you, of course, everything's very simple. But Squarespace is the perfect platform for building large websites for businesses, corporations, and of course, as you were just discussing with your wife, online stores. And generally, you're going to end up having quite a few different people who are contributing to the website, just like Trek FM. So Drew, you're our TOS editor. Of course, Shar is our managing editor. We have other writers. We want people to be able to go into different parts of the site, access different pages, and make different types of changes. We don't want everyone to have universal admin privileges to the site. And Squarespace makes it really easy for you to do this kind of site management using contributors. So you can invite different contributors to help you manage your website, and you can set individual permissions. You can go all the way from full admin to just a trusted commenter. So if you use Squarespace's integrated forums and commenting features, you can just choose someone who you know is going to be a great commenter on your site, and you can make them a trusted commenter. So some examples: administrator, billing, comment moderator. Of course, you always need someone who can go in and do that kind of moderation. A store manager. Maybe your wife's business grows and grows and you have to bring in someone to just manage it so she can focus on the other aspects of the business. You can set that person to be your store manager, and they're going to have the specific privileges that you give them based on that role. You can have content editors, someone who just does reporting. It's a fantastic way to manage your website and make sure that the people who need to do certain jobs can do it without someone who shouldn't have access to another area, you know, accidentally messing something up. Because, hey, it happens. You know, they don't mean to mess something up, but it's a wrong click somewhere because they're not familiar with that area. So Squarespace gives you fantastic tools to do that through their contributor roles. And also, while we're on this topic, because it ties in really well, Drew, let's just touch on the key points of the new commerce feature. And these, of course, are something that I hope you and your wife will be using in the near future. You can just instantly create a store and sell products using Squarespace. I've jumped through a lot of hoops over the years, setting up online stores for clients, figuring out how to do the billing, how to accept orders, how to process credit cards, how to manage shipping. And of course, you have to think about taxes as well. And you know, luckily, here in Japan, we have the same tax rate everywhere. But in a country like the US, that's certainly not the case. It's extremely complicated. And what Squarespace has done is they have a deal with Stripe, and Stripe allows you to, with just a couple of minutes setting up an account, you can create an online store, you can accept credit cards, and the system will actually manage all those different tax rates for you on your orders, even in places like California where you've got so many different tax rates within one state. It takes all the headache and all the stress out of online commerce and just lets you focus on making great products, selling those, and sending them out to the customers who love you.
That's really cool. Well, it looks like you can sell music CDs or MP3s or hardcover books or ebooks or anything that you can think of. They've got it integrated in there.
Right. Physical, digital goods, either one. You could even set up coupons for your customers. So all that's integrated. And, you know, in the past, you'd have to go to several different places to get those capabilities. It's all right in here with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. So we'd like to invite you to try this for yourself. It's really easy. Squarespace gives you a 14-day full-featured trial. No questions asked, no credit card. You just go sign up, create the account. You have access to all the tools. You can even import your site from tools like WordPress. So you can keep your current site going while you import it into Squarespace and see how it's going to look there. And then you could tweak it, make it all your own, and you can see how the commerce would work if you're interested in an online store. And then when you decide to sign up, Squarespace has an offer for Trek FM listeners. You can get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using the offer code TREK4. So the way you do this is you go to squarespace.com/trek. Do go to that URL to tie it into Trek FM and use the offer code TREK4. And you'll be up and running in just a matter of minutes. I guarantee you, you're going to love it. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website, and you'll be supporting our sponsor and helping us bring this programming to you each week. So, Drew, as we move into a very brief movie news and rumors this week, the first thing we have up is related to comics, and we're going to talk about After Darkness. Now, have you been reading the Countdown to Darkness lead-in to the movie?
I have. I really enjoyed Countdown before the first movie came out, and so I was excited, and I was reading ongoing between the movies. I was really excited to have another show or another comic to tie into the movie, because I'm really big on expanded universe stuff and getting all the information that I can. So I was really excited about it. And then I was really excited to read that there was going to be a sequel set immediately after the events of Into Darkness. So I'm guessing not everyone dies. Or they'd be really short comic books. I know what it is. It's just black pages. It's just darkness. Because we went into darkness, and now that's all there is.
Right, and this is After Darkness. It's actually after the dark has fallen. We're actually in the darkness itself right now. So, we've joked on here about the fact that they did reveal the cover for ongoing number 21, and everyone's on the cover. So we assume that everyone survives the movie, but in fact, it could be a memorial cover.
They
could simply be remembering the crew. We won't know until it comes out. But we knew that ongoing number 21 was going to pick up immediately after the movie. That had been announced. But they hadn't really said that it was going to be a sequel to the movie. It was just going to be picking up after the movie and then moving on forward with the ongoing stories as they've been doing. But now they're saying that this is actually going to be an official sequel covering three issues, and it's going to be called Star Trek After Darkness. And this will be ongoing number 21, number 22, and number 23.
Which is interesting that they're not separating it. Like, we've still had ongoings as we've been getting the Countdown to Darknesses. But now the After Darknesses are going to be spun back into ongoing. I'm not a huge comic fan, but I don't know if this is normal or abnormal. But it's interesting that they're just going to rebrand some of the ongoing to be official sequel.
That's what it sounds like they're doing. Now, you said in the other side of the room that you haven't been reading the ongoing comics themselves from the first issue on through. You've just been reading the Countdown comics, I believe, right?
No, no. I've been reading the ongoing, just not the last few.
Not the backstories of the characters?
Not the backstory ones, because I figured that the backstories probably won't tie into the movie as much as the official tie-in to the movie would.
Maybe not, although I think that the Uhura backstory comic gave a little bit of insight into her character and why she is much more involved in the action that's taking place in Into Darkness than you might expect from Uhura, just based on the Nichelle Nichols Uhura of the Prime universe.
I was going to wait for a sale and then just pick up all the issues that I was missing.
Well, they will gather them in an omnibus. Yeah, they will do that. So seeing how ongoing has led up to this point, I think it makes sense that they would not do a completely separate set of comics. Like, instead of having ongoing number 21 right after the movie, plus After Darkness number 1, they'll just kind of keep it going. So we'll see what the story's going to be. Scott Dombier, who's the Star Trek editor, said that we are thrilled to follow up Star Trek Into Darkness with this exclusive story in the ongoing comic series. As with our prequel Countdown to Darkness, having Mr. Orsi overseeing After Darkness ensures that the events in the comic seamlessly continue from the events of the film. And I think that is the good thing here, that they have had Bad Robot involved and Orsi has been overseeing what's been going on. They've had Mike Johnson writing, and he's going to be writing After Darkness as well. That stability, continuity, and tie-in to the people involved in the film really helped to make this all work together.
Yeah, you can tell from the dialogue and stuff. You can hear the new characters saying these things. Like, especially in the Countdown to Darkness stuff, you can really, all the dialogue, it's got the humor and the pacing and stuff, that you can read it with Pine and Quinto and stuff in mind. It works really, really well.
It does work quite well, yeah. So I'm looking forward to this. I've read all the ongoing, all the Countdown, even the Keenzer backstory.
That was the last one I bought. I don't know why I bought that.
Maybe that's why you stopped reading the backstories. You're like, Keenzer, he's the first one, really? Maybe I'm going to skip these backstories. That was an interesting choice. But yeah, I'm looking forward to these. And I'm also looking forward to the ongoing 24 through 26, the Much After Darkness.
No. That's the beginning of lightness again.
The beginning of lightness.
The Star Trek, the JJ Star Trek beginning of lightness comic book.
I see. I thought it was going to be very pensive, like the Cardigans album, Long Gone Before Daylight. All right. Well, let's move on. We have one last story before we get into our feature. And this is Empire Magazine's May covers. And Drew, this should be very interesting to you, because not only is it related to Into Darkness, but it's also related to Star Wars.
Yeah.
Empire's May issue is called the J.J. Abrams issue, and it's going to focus on Into Darkness, but it's also going to focus on his past work in Lost and future work on Star Wars. And the cover is spectacular. It is a 4-page foldout of J.J. Abrams and the entire Into Darkness cast, with futuristic San Francisco in the background. And I've actually stood this exact spot where J.J. Abrams' chair is. I have actually stood there with my own camera to take photos of San Francisco. So I recognize
this awesome.
Place.
I actually, for Ex Astra Scientia, I went through Google Maps or Google Earth and figured out where, like, the where on the Presidio that Starfleet Academy is and where Starfleet Command is using the 3D features. So I've virtually stood in that spot on Google Earth. The cover is really neat looking. It's got JJ sitting in New Kirk's chair with the entire bridge crew plus Cumberbatch. I did read a lot of comments, people upset that McCoy is not on the cover, that Uhura keeps getting the new poster. It's Uhura, Kirk, and Spock. And this cover is Uhura, Kirk, and Spock.
It is. But fans, buy the issue, because if you do the full pullout, not only is McCoy on the cover, he's dead center of the entire photograph, mm-hmm. right behind J.J. Abrams. He is actually the most prominent character from the movie if you look at the entire photograph. So he is definitely there.
I think it's interesting they put Alice Eve like toward the end in between Sulu and Chekhov instead of like focusing, bringing her to the center, you know, trying to focus on the new characters. Let's look at the new actors. No, they're just like, look, she's in the movie. She's important in the movie, but she's over here. I hope this isn't like the importance of the characters in the movie itself. That would be interesting if Scotty was the fifth most important person in the movie, though.
Well, we do see him hugging Uhura a lot, so you never know. But it could be, because I think it's becoming pretty clear from the trailers and from the comics, and on the Countdown to Darkness comics, they chose to make Kirk, Spock, and Uhura the three characters on three different issues. It does seem to be that the trifecta in this movie is not Kirk, Spock, and Bones, but Kirk, Spock, and Uhura.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on that. I like that they've stepped out on their own and not just depended on the old tropes and cliches of the original series. I do miss having Bones in that position, but I also like that they've given Uhura something to do, and the fact that she's in there, in that trifecta, is, it's good. It shows some progress since the 60s when, you know, we said things like you'll discover in the feature, you know, Star Trek hasn't been entirely kind to women.
Yeah. So we'll see. And that's the problem with these movies is, you know, every 4 years we're getting 2 hours worth of material. So it's not like the TV show where, you know, Bones can be part of that all the time. There's just not enough material here. So we'll see. But the cover is beautiful. So look out for this Empire. Even if you don't want to read the magazine, I would recommend that you just pick up a copy of it just for the photograph and the foldout, because it's a great shot.
We set down on Omicron SETI-3. I was infected by the spores. Now I have been set free. Protected from the deadly brittle rains. In perfect health as peace and love, we live in harmony.
We all knew that Worf was not a merry man, but that all changed when he joined a new crew in the episode, The Way of the Spores. And, oh wait, that was The Way of the Warrior, and he still was not merry. The Way of the Spores was actually the name of the original story concept that became This Side of Paradise, and the man who got merry was Spock. Today we're going to talk about This Side of Paradise, and to help us do that, we have two first-time voices on the Ready Room. Now, a familiar voice to many of you from Trek News and Views and Decade is Kate Walsh, coming to us from Australia. Hello, Kate.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing well. And also, first time with us from Mission Log, we have John Champion. Hello, John.
Hey, everybody. It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Great to have you with us, John. So, we are going to kick off This Side of Paradise. Now, Drew, you are our TOS editor, so why don't you kick us off?
Well, This Side of Paradise is the episode with the spores, as Chris has already said. And flowers basically take over the ship and make everybody feel groovy, including Spock, who's especially affected by them, and hangs from trees and makes out with girls
very quickly.
And it's really weird to see the blurry, off focus effect for a woman when Spock looks at her. You don't get that very often.
He had the little Vulcan twinkles in his eyes, didn't he?
I'd also like to point out that they were friends 6 years before, and Spock goes through Pon Farr the next year. So I don't know if she just didn't time herself correctly, but she should have been around for the last time.
Yeah, she had bad timing.
Maybe she just missed it.
You know that, I'm glad you mentioned hanging upside down out of the tree, because I'm watching that and I'm like, you know, Spock reminds me, I had this friend in high school whose parents sheltered him until he was truly an adult, and he went to university with me and he discovered alcohol and he became an alcoholic. He just like went to the extreme because he was so sheltered. And what it reminded me of with Spock was like, he's so repressed all the time. And as soon as he gets those spores in him, he just goes all out, right? He's holding hands, he's making out, he's looking at cloud shapes, he's hanging upside down out of a tree branch, cracking up laughing. Like, Spock, come on, just moderation. Yeah, moderation.
He's a flower-loving, fun-loving, hippie Vulcan all of a sudden.
Yes.
A true flower child.
Yes. Yes. It was indeed. John, yeah. You have explored this episode quite thoroughly not too long ago on Mission Log.
No kidding.
What
you
are your
say.
Basic thoughts on this episode?
It amazes me that this one episode is the episode that will not die. Out of all the provocative, really challenging material handled by Star Trek, that on Mission Log, we've talked about religion and morality and all these things, and we got the most mail, the most feedback, the most commentary about this side of paradise. And to me, at first glance, I thought it was a very simple, easy story to grapple with. You got spores, they mess with people's minds. That's not a good idea. We need to get the people away from the spores. Done. And somehow, this turned into a huge, huge discussion. But a fascinating one. And it took us down paths that I never expected that we would go down. I still maintain, and I still believe that the thrust of this episode is that when you alter somebody's perception, when you alter somebody's mind, particularly against their consent, that this is a bad thing. We have to undo that and be able to look at the problem objectively. But there is a case to be made for the idea that on a bigger scale, on a grander topic, if we're just looking at the nature of happiness and we say, well, these people are happy, they say that they're happy, they say that they don't want to leave, who are we to then go in and change that? And I don't want to get off topic too much here, but kind of the same thing comes up with the apple. But the big, big difference is that with this side of paradise, they are humans from Earth on a mission. In the apple, they are aliens that we know nothing about. And Kirk still kind of does the same thing. Oh, well, it's too bad you're happy. We're going to have to take all of that away from you now. You know?
At least he had orders this time to get them off the planet because of the radiation, not because they were happy.
Right. Right.
I like how he used that radiation as a cover instead of saying, I have orders to take away your happiness. He didn't say that.
Right.
But
right.
That's what he's thinking.
I mean, I don't think it's as simple as just, taking away someone's happiness, because in this particular instance, none of these people went into this situation by choice. By removing the influence of the spores from them, it then gave them that choice back, or certainly the crew gave their choices back, and none of them decided to go back to that planet and be happy because it was a false happiness.
Yeah, I think you hit on it exactly. You know, the difficulty in doing an analysis of a show like Star Trek, and particularly the way that we do it on Mission Log, is that you kind of have to go just with what you're given. And we could go down all these paths of what if, what if, what if. But ultimately, we have to come back to what we're actually given on screen. And, you know, you could say, well, what if you could pull these people away from it objectively and say, okay, your mind has been affected by a spore. Here's what the spore does to you. Now, do you want to go back? And they may. But a guy like Sandoval at the end says, I've accomplished nothing.
Right.
And to him, at least, on that individual basis, he feels like this was a very bad proposition to live the rest of his life under the influence of the spores. But then you take that into, you know, again, this bigger picture idea, and it really does ask the question, well, what do humans need to be happy? And Ken and I kind of argue about this a lot on Star Trek. He says that Kirk basically has this mission to go around and remove happiness from people everywhere.
He's
on any planet
that
he
can.
Yeah, exactly. But I look at it a very different way. I look at it, I'm a big fan of Carl Sagan. And
yeah,
there's a line that he has that I absolutely love. It is far better to grasp the universe as it really is than to persist in delusion, however satisfying and reassuring. And to me, that Star Trek does that a lot. It says, okay, here's the good, here's the bad. But regardless of that, there is a truth here. There's a basic understanding of facts that we have to have. Now, what you can argue about is the method or the solution that Kirk comes up with. You know, that is rife for argument. And we've just been very lucky so far in season one of the original series that Kirk has made a lot of good decisions. He's kind of lucked out that way.
Yeah, you mentioned at the end when Sandoval says we've done nothing here. He says no accomplishments, no progress. We've wasted 3 years and we wanted to make this planet a garden. And it kind of felt, like you said, Kate, they didn't go into this willingly. The spores put them into this state. And, you know, it's also mentioned in here that this is kind of like a happiness pill. And this whole concept reminds me of two different things that I'd like to talk about. One of them is a parallel to drug addiction. And then another is whether or not this episode is a reaction to the hippie movement of the 60s. And on the case of drug addiction, I think people will often enter into drug addiction not with the intention of getting lost in that world, of course. You know, they start out just because makes them feel good, especially with alcohol, where it seems very benign at first to have a few drinks. But eventually it's possible that you just get completely lost in that world, and maybe you feel like you're happy at least while you're high or while you're drunk. It's very hard to break out of it. And at the end of this, Sandoval kind of reminded me of that person who had perhaps been lost in addiction, in this case for 3 years. And then when they finally get sober and they snap out of it and they realize that they've just wasted that 3 years of their life and they haven't accomplished anything, but then he's ready to maybe make up for the lost time, get back on track with what they had originally intended to do.
And I think that's more to the point than it, this is about them being happy and someone coming in and spoiling their happiness. It's, as I said, it's restoring self-empowerment to them and the ability to make choices about their lives and to do the things that they set out to do that the spores got in the way of, because it squashed all of that drive.
Well thankfully, right, we got the Berthold radiation, which would it gave Kirk, I mean, it not just as an excuse for Kirk, but it also gave the plot something to move toward getting these people the help that they need. That they need to get off.
Well, that's just it. It's a really good sci-fi twist that if you say it's drug addiction, well, the way to portray drug addiction in the real world is that drugs have this temporary high effect and people feel good from it, but it also has debilitating and horrible physical effects, and that you can see when you talk to anybody who has been through that or helps people who go through that. So it's a great kind of sci-fi twist that we get to look at it from a different angle and say, well, what if the drug actually provides nothing but good? Mm-hmm. It provides happiness and it provides health, and you don't know any better. So these are all kind of quote unquote good things. So now you have to make a different kind of case for being on or being off that drug. I think that's what's so compelling about this show. So now if you look at it as a metaphor for drug addiction, you now have to make the case that just being on drugs is bad. Being high is bad. Because the other angle that we talk to each other about drug addiction, well, it is physically addicting. You will die from it. There are all these other things that we get to layer on top of it. I have no doubt that this episode was inspired by that. And they may have just kind of stopped at that point when they said, hey, here's an interesting metaphor for drugs. Let's see where we can go with it, and let's see how we can change it around to make it more Star Trek, make it more Alien. And they did that very well. But ultimately, what you come back to is this idea of, well, philosophically, who are we to say that that is right or that is wrong? I fully agree, and I think all of us on this panel agree, that it is wrong from the point of view of consent. They had no choice.
Right. Well, I think more than that, I think there's also two layers of right and wrong going on here. One is to do with the individual's choices about what's right and wrong for them. And the other is about the effect that it has on society, which is where Kirk's coming from.
Yeah.
Well, whether it's a ship or society at large.
Right.
And what we need to be able to grow and defend ourselves and to develop and be better as a society.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the question that we grappled with, is to say, well, do we need a certain level of unhappiness in order to be better than we are, in order to progress, in order to move forward? Because by that definition, then happiness is not something you will ever achieve. Mm-hmm. You will achieve accomplishment. You will achieve solutions to problems. But the happiness yardstick, the happiness goalpost, will keep moving. I'm actually kind of okay with that. You know, just from a personal, philosophical, moral outlook, I'm okay with that entirely. But that's the sort of my worldview, that happiness isn't a thing that you get to and then you stop.
Like it says in the Declaration of Independence, where it says life, liberty, mm-hmm. and the pursuit of happiness? I mean, rights that we're looking for are, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not happiness, but the goal, the looking forward to ever-increasing happiness. And that may be the problem with the spores, is that it gave you life and it gave you happiness, but it didn't give you liberty or the pursuit of happiness. And so it's kind of a half freedom.
So it's about the journey rather than the destination.
Right. They gave you the destination, and there's no journey.
And that's something that even Harry Kim understood.
Exactly. And if Harry Kim can understand it,
even Harry Kim,
a kindergartner, can understand it.
But you know, here when Kirk is ready to beam down to the planet, and he's got his, as you guys pointed out, John is Samsonite, and mm-hmm. I know that Kirk's a one bag man, so you know that you know that the flight attendants are always happy when Kirk shows up,
right?
But he says that he can't leave. It's emotions, violent emotions, needs, and anger. Now, I don't know about the violent emotions part, but I think needs and anger, or at least feelings of discontent, I think that those are things that we need. I think that we all strive for happiness, but if you were to achieve what you felt was pure happiness, you would stop moving forward. And as people and as a society, it is that drive and that pursuit of happiness that keeps us evolving, both socially and technologically and scientifically. You know, you have to think that there's perhaps some point where a group of our ancestors long ago felt like, hey, I'm pretty happy. This is working for me. I'm just going to stay here. And if we all did that as a society, we wouldn't get anywhere.
I'm in.
Those people immediately got conquered.
Right.
I'm impressed that the Star Trek universe progressed beyond the holodeck. Yeah. You know, because once they had that, do you need anything else?
Yeah, you figure when the holodeck was invented, that was the end. That's right.
Now, I must admit, when I was listening to the Mission Log podcast, and there was that debate going on about happiness and whether we should be happy or whether we should be striving for it, and I felt a little bit uncomfortable with this idea of happiness as something that we should be aiming for. I mean, to me, I prefer to think in terms of contentedness. And that's probably something I strive for, with moments of happiness interspersed throughout it. I think it's a fleeting thing. I think you need that light and shade to be able to appreciate the happiness as well.
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, because then you could almost look at a cross section of humans and realize that there are some who are very ambitious, who will never be content, who will never be happy, if that's the word we'll use. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there may be some who would jump at the chance to have this euphoria that something like the Spore would allow them. That would create a very big division in this world, obviously, if they have to intermingle. But I do think, and I think that's also a part of Ken's point, is I do think that given an opportunity, if you could objectively present this to some people and say, if you have this available to you for the rest of your life, you will be happy, you will not want, you will be healthy, and you won't know the difference. You won't even realize that there is another way to feel. I think that there are some people who would take that. Now, what's interesting about Star Trek is that as happy, as progressive a future as it presents, it still constantly presents this idea that human beings need to search, they need to explore, they need to be better tomorrow than what they are today. And I think that's just one of those big, giant Star Trek themes that we come across over and over again. We just present it in different ways, you know. Again, you can argue the moral decision that Kirk makes regarding the people of Val when it comes to the apple, because we know nothing about them. but when it comes to our own, I think that is a big statement about kind of human nature.
Well, let's come back around to this topic in a moment, because I'd like to talk about the possible parallels to the hippie movement. But why don't we talk about Spock a little bit? Because now the original story centered on Sulu, which I found it interesting that the original story was a medical condition that would force Sulu to resign from Starfleet, but the spores somehow magically cure him. I like centering the story on Spock a whole lot better. I'm very glad that DC Fontana stepped in and did this. And instead of Happy Sulu, we get the Love Spock, which, as everyone knows, was one of the biggest hits by the B-52s back in the 80s. So let's talk about Love Spock a little bit more, and how you took this version of Spock that was, I mean, he was so quick to become happy. One thing I will say leading in, though, Layla is surprised at how the spores seem to be very painful for Spock when he inhales them, and that didn't happen to the humans. And all Spock says is, "I am not like you." My thoughts on it were that perhaps because the spores are breaking down that barrier, maybe guard to the emotions, because Vulcans actually have stronger emotions than humans even, but they keep them repressed. As that is being broken down by the spores, even though it happens very quickly, perhaps that's why it was more painful for Spock.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe he got some of that confetti in his eye that hurt him.
It hurt Leonard Nimoy, not Spock.
Well, it's kind of a cool thing about our understanding of Vulcans up until that point, and then what we get about Vulcans after. I think this is a big, big turning point, not just for Spock, but for the whole Vulcan character, because a few episodes later, we get to Amok time, and we get to see Vulcan hormones run wild. And we really get that picture of the seething pit of raw emotions that Vulcans really have, but they've managed to keep suppressed for all of this time. And it is interesting because you kind of make the point that if they didn't do that, Vulcans may have self-destructed over the centuries, the millennia, the eons that they've been doing this. So imagine how different this would have been if it had been about Sulu. Yeah, we could have related to the human problem, but now we get to magnify it under mm-hmm. Spock. And I think that's really cool. I think it's a great choice, and it really does set the stage for so much about the Spock character that comes after.
I mean, there's a lot of locking down of Spock and his character and Vulcans in this episode. I mean, they call him a Vulcanian at first, but then Kirk calls him a Vulcan when he's making fun of him. And we establish mm-hmm. that his father is an ambassador and his mother's a teacher. And I really think that DC went through and basically established all of the Vulcan stories we get from that point from this episode. Mm-hmm. And so it's good that Spock was the focus, because if he was the one who is immune because he's the alien, that wouldn't be very fun. The fact that Kirk is the one that's immune because he's so angry at everybody else for being stupid, it makes it that much better.
Isn't that interesting that Kirk is the angriest guy on the ship? Nobody else was angry enough, but it took Kirk being angry enough. It's one of those traits then to be a starship captain. You have to have just right. enough powerful
That's his secret.
Anger.
He's always angry. Yeah. Like the Hulk.
But was he actually immune? I mean, when those spores shot themselves out at Kirk and Sulu, and if you actually look, there were no spores whatsoever on Kirk's face or tunic. There were none. Like, they were very directional. So maybe he wasn't immune. Maybe they just missed him at that point. And having then seen what it did to his crew, you know, he was really the only one that had the choice of whether to subject himself to that or not.
Maybe. I kind of took that as with any disease, any kind of infection, you know, some people are more susceptible than others. Some people's bodies are able to put up a stronger defense. And I kind of took that as the first time the spores tried to infect Kirk, as they walked up to that extremely suspicious-looking battery of giant flowers. It's like, hey, guys, why don't you come right over here? I'd like to talk to you about something. Can we talk here? No, why don't we go over there with that gigantic flower bed where they're all pointing right out at you? We'll talk over there. But as that exploded on them, and it didn't affect Kirk, I thought that, well, you know, this case here, I mean, we call it anger, but I think that in Kirk, it's not necessarily anger as much as it's sort of his strong will and his drive, that it didn't affect him then. And then on the bridge, as he's sitting there, and that one sneaky flower zaps him.
It just kind of pokes into frame.
I know. It's like, I'm going to get you now. Bam! Gotcha.
And maybe the lesson here is that you can only be truly happy if you get a really big face full of white stuff.
Oh!
Maybe.
Maybe that is
Show's
what they
over.
Were going for.
25 minutes. That's really good. I expected the entire show to be full of things like this.
Kate is known for her innuendo. It's a good thing Char's not here with her today. Then we would have gone off the rails.
Yeah. So, yeah.
25 seconds into the show. But what I'm saying is that, so Kirk, he has a strong defense against this, but eventually it gets him. But even after he is infected, his body is still fighting against that. Mm-hmm. His mind is still fighting against that. And that's why he's able, just before he beams off the ship, to realize something's going on to snap out of it.
It's because he was leaving the Enterprise.
Right. He's leaving his girl. The Enterprise is his one true girlfriend. And that snaps him out of it. But when I rewatch this, you know, knowing what's going to happen, often when I get to the look that he gives as he's on the bridge after he has been hit by the flower and he gets that little smile, I feel like, you know, the writing is meant to make you think he's infected when he really isn't. But then I think, no, he actually is infected and he is preparing to leave the ship, and then he snaps out of it at the last minute. So, but with Kirk, I feel that it's not so much pure anger that helps him fight this off and that drives him, but it's one thing that I like about Kirk is he always, you know, finds a way out of situations. He's always ready to explore. He's always thinking about the puzzle from different angles. He even makes a comment in this episode that it's like a jigsaw puzzle, all one color. I mean, to him, this is something he has to figure out, as Kirk always does.
Agreed. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it may not just be that angry side that that we see in The Enemy Within that is so on display there. But like you say, it's a drive that he has that is a strong quality of his leadership. To keep pushing. Again, I'm a little shocked that there aren't others on board who have that too. Maybe it just takes them a little longer to get there. But, you know, Sandoval's crew has been under that for 3 years. And you wonder why a guy like Sandoval, who only then realizes that he accomplished nothing, everything that his life has been leading up to at that point, you wonder why he had no ability to fight it back. Or maybe he did at one point, but was ultimately overcome, because where else are you going to go except a planet full of spores?
It was surprising how quickly the Enterprise crew succumbed to the spores. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of them were just like, oh yeah, I'm happy, let's go. And, oh, okay, so John, now, like me, you are from Alabama. Actually, I don't know, yes. Drew and Kate, if you guys know, John and I, we didn't know each other. We grew up down the street from each other in Birmingham.
Wow.
But we went to different high schools.
Indeed.
Yep. It was amazing. But John, you of course know who Paul Feinbaum is.
Oh, right? Yeah, of course.
Right. As I'm watching this episode, I get the feeling that after just a couple more mint juleps, Bones could call in to the Paul Feinbaum show and just pass for a regular caller.
I don't know what
he gets
it is.
So
much of a drawl.
that accent, yeah.
Enterprise. I mean, it makes Trip.
Jim Boy.
It makes Trip Tucker sound like he's well educated.
Come on, Jim Boy. Why don't you come on down here to the planet with me? You ever had one of them Georgia mint juleps?
One of them completely fictitious Georgia-style mint juleps?
Why don't you come on down?
Yeah,
you know,
the
Alabama-Auburn game's about to start. We got a TV down here in the cabin. Just come on down, Jim Boy.
That's a weird choice, wasn't it? That was a really weird choice.
Yeah. For those of you who didn't listen to the mission log, there's no such thing as a Georgia-style mint julep. They're based out of Kentucky, and so we don't know. We don't know. Maybe in the future.
No.
Maybe in the future they make their own style of it.
If this had been the next generation, he would have said, "Have you ever had a good Tarkalian style mint julep?"
Yeah,
it would always be off-world. Tarkalians are great with their beverages.
Ractogino, it's Klingon coffee. It's better than regular coffee. You know, it's got to be alien.
Oh. But back to Spock, I was just so surprised at how quickly Spock became giddy and just starts laying down, making out with Layla. You know, there's that point where Kirk keeps paging him and Layla's stroking his hair and he's checking out dragon clouds and stuff. And I just expected Spock to stand up and grab the communicator and say, damn it, Jim, I'm making out here. Would you please stop bothering me?
Yeah, well, so 2 points about that. First of all, I want to go back to what you were saying about the spores on the Enterprise and how quick they were to take over everybody. You know, people keep saying that the spores are not malicious, the spores are benign. I disagree. Even if it's not intended, their biological evolutionary drive is to propagate, and they do that by taking over everything around them. I mean, you mentioned it, Drew, that plant that pops up over the navigation console and just goes right for Kirk, you know, that is a plant with a mission.
It is.
that is, you know. But back to Spock and what's going on with him, this kind of goes back to the big question here and the big issue of this episode is that, okay, so we get to reveal this side of Spock that up until now we don't really know about. But then you have to ask yourself, Spock has spent his entire adult life being educated, going to Starfleet, doing all of this to become the person that he is. And now we're meant to believe, if you side with the spores, that all he really wants to do is hang upside down from a tree and make out with his girlfriend. I mean, that's good for a while. Okay, I have no problem with that for up until a certain point. But is that really Spock? Is that truly the person that we know Spock to be? And more importantly, is that the person that Spock wants to be? But you rip that choice right out from under him and just say, well, too bad. Now this is who you are.
Yeah, I mean, I see that, John. And that's kind of the weird thing here for me, that I do have trouble believing that this is who Spock really is inside and that he's suppressing that all the time, and the spores have let that out. That is kind of a weak point for me in the story, that I can't buy that that's who Spock is. You know, maybe I can buy that Bones wants to hang outside and enjoy the fresh air and have a mint julep that has way too much mint in it. I mean, that was like a tree in that glass. But yeah, Spock hanging upside down out of the tree was a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, what we think of when we think of Spock is we think of his restraint. We think of his wall that was destroyed by the spores. And yeah, without that wall, it's not Spock. And I don't think that's McCoy. I mean, this is similar to the Naked Now. I imagine that Sulu's running around the planet with his fencing sword and his shirt off.
Probably.
Right. Yeah.
Looking for animals.
But I don't think that that's Sulu. I don't think that the true Sulu, you know, is shirtless with a fencing sword.
That's right. Way I see what the spores does to people is it strips away the dark side, the negative emotions, and you're left with this positive stuff. So in humans, the change is not going to be anywhere near as dramatic, because our emotions aren't felt as deeply as they are with Vulcans. So it's quite possible that having stripped away all of that really dark emotion, which is underneath the wall of the Vulcans, that the positive stuff which is left is that much more powerful as well. So maybe that's why it seems to be out of perspective.
You know, it's kind of amazing that the settlers were even able to build those houses that they built. Because right. You think you get hit by the spores and you're like, we can do that tomorrow. We don't need to go look for wood. We don't need to cut down trees to turn into lumber, to put together, to paint. We're fine.
I mean, care how many facefuls of spores I've gotten. I'm not going to be happy if I'm vegetarian.
Agreed. Yes.
Well, I mean, we never got confirmation that those other civilizations, like they split off into three different groups, that those other two groups even existed. You know, they could have eaten them.
Right.
Maybe that's what was in those barns that DeSalle or whoever was looking in. There's no cows, just people.
So, John, okay, this is a good point to transition into the parallel that I also see to the hippie movement of the 60s. If you think of something like Woodstock, where people were so content with gathering and being in the state of group happiness, if we want to just call it that, you know, as a parallel for what's going on here, you talk about how it's surprising that the colonists were even able to build the houses in the first place. Massive group of people, as we had, say, at Woodstock, who were all into this kind of carefree, happy world, love and peace. I cannot picture those people building houses or furthering the society. And so I feel like, because of the time that this story was written and as that movement was gaining momentum in the 60s, I feel like this story is also, in a way, and this is what Kirk's point is to me, a reaction to that movement and a reaction to that saying that, look, it's great to be happy. That's wonderful. We would all like to have paradise, but we can't just pretend that everything's perfect, and we can't pretend that the real world and the threats around us don't exist. We have to snap out of it. And that, again, whereas, you know, we can joke about Kirk wanting to go and take people's happiness away, but I do think Kirk has a good point here. At least in his mind, ultimately what he is trying to say is that this type of utopian view can't work, because in the real world, you know, the society will die in this case. There are always going to be threats from the outside. At that point in time, you know, we had a threat from the Soviets. We had the Vietnam War heading into that. And I do feel like this is a bit of a reaction to that movement.
Well, two things, and I'll kind of play Ken's advocate here, in the respect that, first of all, the settlers on that planet were not pretending to be happy. They were happy.
Right. No, that is true.
Now, it was a falsely induced state, but right. They were happy, and they were committed to that. And the other thing is, we don't necessarily know that they had any outside threat. They were healthy. They had enough food to eat. The Bertholdt radiation was kept away from them. That was no longer a threat because of the spores, because the spores were soaking it up. So in the context of that show, you can still make the argument on the other side. Now, what you're saying about the hippie movement, and it is interesting because you kind of inextricably link the hippie movement with the drug metaphor here as well. I think you kind of have to do that, at least our understanding of the hippie movement in the 60s. I agree with you, because I think that whenever so far we have seen attempts at utopian living, they ultimately fall apart. Whether it's hippie communes of the 60s, these sort of, you know, back to nature, living off the land, ultimately enough people want out because their needs aren't being met by that. Whether it's personally or technologically or socially, whatever those needs are, they are not being met by that utopian ideal. And history is littered with these fallen utopias. I you know, something just popped into mind, which is a little bit different angle on it, but I'm a big Disney fan, and I don't know who else here is as well, but, you know, in the late 60s, when Walt was designing Epcot, the thing that would become the Epcot theme park in the 80s, that was not a theme park. That was designed as a city. A utopian, modern, idealistic city. And he had it all worked out. He you know, you have the central core in the middle for commerce, for business. You had the homes that would sort of, like the spokes of a wheel, kind of go out from that central city into the suburbs. And it was really well thought out. It was really creative. It was impressive as hell on paper and in the model. But then the sort of cold, hard reality hits you of, okay, who's going to pay for this, first of all? Who's going to live there? And who's going to live there in a satisfied and satisfactory way, because everything is sort of designed from the top down. You remove an element of personal determination from that. And Kate, this kind of goes back to what you were saying about self-determination, the right and the drive of the individual in that group to do what they want to do. So hippies, yes. I mean, maybe this is kind of a slap directly at the hippies. But in the bigger picture, this sort of utopian ideal, Star Trek presents its own kind of utopia. But something that I like about the original series is that it is a multifaceted utopia. It is a utopia full of people who still have problems, who still grapple with themselves and their environment and their coworkers, but they still find a way at the end of the day to kind of pull it together and solve the problem. You know, you could make an argument about later Star Trek not having that as much, painting these sort of perfect people. And the later and later you get past Next Gen into Voyager, things like that. You lose that sort of the rough side of that diamond, which I think is so interesting to explore in original Star Trek.
Yeah.
Right. With the exception of Deep Space Nine, although even within Deep Space Nine, the Starfleet personnel themselves internally are still a lot like they are, as you're describing, in the later Star Trek. And
right. Well, and that's just it. Yeah.
They're able to get the rough edges by introducing outsiders.
Yeah. And that was sort of the edict. You mentioned Harry Kim earlier, and this is a really interesting interview point that Garrett Wong has made many times about his dissatisfaction with Voyager, is that the edict came down from the top to say, oh, no, the human characters aren't emotional.
Yeah.
Because you have to be perfect in order to be a counterpoint to the aliens. The aliens can be emotional. The aliens can have problems, but the humans don't. Well, then what do we do with that? Where do we find a character, and where do we find conflict? And ultimately, then where do we find the conflict that we get to overcome?
Yeah,
and that's why I'm having such a good time with being stuck in the original series right now with Mission Log, because that's the really cool stuff to discover or rediscover.
Yeah, if you can't see yourself amongst the human characters, if you can't, like, you know, what if I was this guy out in space, which is what I like about Enterprise, is that you can see yourself in each of the characters. They're all out there. They're unknown. They're emotional. They're imperfect. But in, like, Next Generation and Voyager, the characters are so beyond us, like they've already evolved to the next stage, and it's hard to find yourself in it. And sure, you know, the aliens are all emotional, but you're supposed to be learning lessons from them, not seeing their points of view and then being told that they're wrong.
Right. I totally agree. Totally agree.
What other thing about Kirk that I questioned as I'm watching it is, and it made me wonder about Starfleet a little bit, or at least about Kirk's motivations, is that they have orders to go to the planet and evacuate the colonists because of this threat from the Berthold radiation. They get there and discover the plant spores, but the reason for visiting the planet is because of the radiation. And I actually forgot about that. Sometimes as I watch this, I forget about that until I'm into the episode, because Kirk is so determined that we're here to remove you from the planet, to evacuate you from the planet. And then I remember, okay, yeah, they're there because of the radiation. But they get there and they see that there is no real threat from radiation. And the colonists seem to be happy. They seem to be healthy. And I wonder, at that point, why doesn't Kirk contact Starfleet and say, we're here, everything seems to be okay, there's no radiation threat, can we just leave them here, let them go about their business, you know, we can go to another mission? But he never contacts Starfleet. He just sticks very rigidly to, I have orders to remove you from the planet. And then it also made me wonder, Starfleet is the military or scientific exploration organization And I know there's a lot of debate over whether Starfleet's a military organization or not. And a lot of people will say, hell no, Starfleet's not a military organization. Their mission is to seek out and explore strange new worlds. But come on, I mean, there is definitely a military structure and mission to Starfleet. And it feels to me that in reality, these colonists would not be sent there by Starfleet. They would be sent there by some other aspect of some other organization on Earth to colonize. So it's like saying here that within the Federation, the military has the right to basically pick you up and move you at will. And Kirk is carrying out that mission. And I find that kind of odd.
Well, I wonder if it's not Starfleet's call, but that Starfleet ordered Kirk to do it. Like, hey, you know, these scientists back on Earth just realized that this planet's going to be full of Berthold raids. We can't have people there. I don't have a ship. I'm a scientist. Starfleet, will you go do this for us? I think is more... I don't think Starfleet's run around telling people they can't do something. I think that they had orders to carry out. The Federation said to go do this, so Starfleet went and did it. And we're also still early in the series where there's no real difference between Federation and Starfleet. And so maybe that's just a flaw of the script at that point.
Maybe it was the United Space Agency that told them to do it.
United Earth Space Agency Probe?
Probe Agency, yes.
But see, if you think about when they first got to the planet, and I mean, I think they did a brilliant job of setting up this mystery of what's going on here. We thought these people were going to be dead. You know, they look like they're alive. That's my best guess, that they are alive.
Sulu wonders if they're zombies.
Is it possible if they're not? Yeah, exactly. So we kind of set up this zombie mystery, which right. You know, probably in itself can be likened to drugs.
I love McCoy's line. McCoy says, on pure speculation, just an educated guess, I'd say that man is alive. Good work, Bones.
So, you know, they start out going in there with these orders, but then they kind of get distracted by this mystery and the investigation as to what's going on there. And one by one, the crew start falling to these spores. And I guess probably that mission gives Kirk some stability amongst all of that chaos. So, you know, it's something that he can control and rely on.
Hmm. Yeah, we do kind of set the stage here for Kirk only getting in touch with Starfleet when he really, really feels like it. And there are other episodes where you would think that Starfleet would have chimed in, and they're just nowhere to be found. But yeah, I think, Drew, you know, you make a good point that we really don't know what the definitions are at this point. Who's Starfleet? Who's the Federation? What are the divisions thereof? What are their missions? But yeah, they expected to show up and find a bunch of corpses. So you would think when that didn't happen that they would at least gotten in touch with another authority. Again, we're back in this position of the what if they had done something differently in this episode.
That's what we do on the Ready Room.
Yeah, right, right. But you know, we're given what we're given, which is that they don't get in touch with anybody else. And then in very short order, you've got a face full of spores for everybody. Yeah, Kate, we're coming back to that. I didn't know it was that kind of show.
Always
for everybody.
Right, right.
Well, even if he had called back to Starfleet or Federation or whoever he was going to call with the, okay, they're not all dead, but we don't know why, his next orders would be find out why they're still there. And so we'd be in the exact same boat. And by the time that the spores start taking over, Uhura's has sabotaged, which he totally says sabotage. She sabotaged the communications, so he couldn't call back, and I think at that point it would have been Kirk's call.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Good point.
And for all of you tech geek detail people out there, we do find out here that the Enterprise can maintain itself in orbit for 3 months, after which point, I don't know what happens, I guess it plummets to the surface of the planet.
That's good that the ship is smart enough to keep itself in orbit, like instead of just being like, I don't know what to do, and just crashing into the ground. It's nice to see some kind of automation.
We pointed this out on Mission Log. I can't remember what episode, but somewhere, somebody's got to install a button on the Enterprise that says, do not allow the orbit to decay. Because constantly they are in a decaying orbit. And you would think that in a starship, priority number one would be to not have a decaying orbit. And yet, Scotty, man, it's a good thing they have him. Because otherwise, it would just be starships hitting planets all the time.
I think there should be a button that's labeled "Go Home."
Yes, so when there's a
problem like this, you just press it, and the ship just goes back to Earth on its own.
Recall button,
right? right.
All right. One other point that I wanted to discuss is an element that was carried over from the original story concept to the final story, but was mostly lost to the point where it leaves you kind of wondering what was going on. And that's what I call lost in translation, but it's the fact that the spores are a collective consciousness. And so in the original story, the spores would infect people, and those people would gain this telepathic ability to communicate with others who had been infected with the spores. So it's a hive mind. It's, you know, we see this, of course, in modern Star Trek with the Borg. We see it in Return of the Archons, which is almost like a proto-Borg type society. And it was the same kind of concept here. And that's where we also get the idea that the spores are benign and they never intended to injure anyone. And they, you know, in the end, they release everyone. But it's this concept of the collective consciousness that I think gets lost in this side of paradise. But I feel that in the writing, it was always there. And then when you get to the end, you still kind of wonder what was the purpose of the spores? What was the goal of the spores? And we've been speculating on that here. Do you feel like that element was needed in the final story to help pull the pieces together?
You know what? I just thought of something. If you take that and run with it, you magnify a spore a few hundred times and you end up with Operation Annihilate, where you've got the space amoeba that are part of a collective consciousness that do have a mission and that are trying to do something. So that could have been something that kind of got shunted over to another episode. It's interesting to see when concepts are added or deleted from a show. I'm just thinking of another one off the top of my head, Doomsday Machine, where in the original treatment that was designed as a being, the Doomsday Machine was a living thing. And we don't know what origin, but you totally change the point of view of the episode when you make it a machine designed for destruction rather than a being that potentially could be communicated with, reasoned with.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, and it's almost that kind of concept, not in destroying a planet, but is maybe carried over into the next generation in Tin Man, because we have another giant ship like the Doomsday Machine a bit that actually is a living being in that case.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the spores, I actually don't have that much of a problem with them being just what they are. Like I said earlier in the show, their evolutionary biological prerogative is to reproduce and to be and to propagate their species. And they do that by using other beings as hosts. And we have that on Earth all the time. We have parasites that only exist in other beings, and then their whole goal is to reproduce and put more of those little parasites into other beings. So I don't have a big problem with that. However it is that they're described or designed, I just think that it is a mistake to think that that they are purely benign. I will say that they do not have intent. And they don't have malicious intent because there is no end goal in sight. But their goal is to have more spores in more people,
mm-hmm.
or whatever host will suit them.
But isn't the intent malicious when it comes to taking over other people's free will? And in effect, that's what they're doing. I mean, we can look at it. Yes, they're making people happy, but they're doing it without having given these people the choice to begin with. And there's a scene earlier on where Leela's saying, or talking to Elias, and he says, "Would you like Spock to stay with us?" And she said to him, "There is no choice." He would stay. Well, and I don't take that's of her doing. That rather, that's the influence of the spores and the effect that they're having on her, which determines that it's a part of her role to go out and to make sure as many people are there as possible to get infected with these spores. And that is a malicious intent if it takes away people's free will. And it's
well,
it's
but
deliberate.
I think that's only from our point of view. You know, there is no communication between the humans and the spores. So if... let me put it this way. For people living on Earth who inhabit a house, you know, to us, a house is just a thing that we go live in, or an apartment building is just a thing we go live in, or tens of thousands of years ago, a cave was just a thing that we live in. We don't ask ourselves if we are somehow impeding the will or the intent of that thing that we live in. There is no communication between us and that thing. I think from the spores' perspective, again, biologically, all they have to do is reproduce. All they have to do is get into more hosts. And the same thing would be true with a parasite on Earth living in another animal. There's not the intention there to say, and we also have to take away its free will. That's a side effect. You know, it's a side effect particular to human beings, but they might also be able to live in other beings, in other animals or whatever, that could at least move them around enough to continue to propagate their species. I think that's all they really care about. If you can even assign the trait of caring to the spores,
well, that's,
you know.
Yeah, that's the
they
thing.
They care
I think
about
it depends.
Making people happy.
All right.
They are, as you said, chronic people pleasers. Right?
Exactly.
But apparently not animal pleasers, because all the animals died. So there were no
right.
happy cows on that planet.
Yeah.
I think to further what John's saying, that it is a matter of perspective. It depends to me if there is an intelligence behind it. You know, they can have a collective consciousness without being intelligent, as we define intelligence. And I think that's where a malicious intent can come in. They definitely have side effects that we perceive as being malicious. Doesn't necessarily mean that they are doing those things with intent themselves. A lot of things in nature may seem like focused intelligence to us when it really isn't, just because of the way we perceive the world.
That it's just what they do, and they don't have that broader awareness.
But it is an interesting idea, though, because if they had gone that route, to say that they have a collective consciousness, to say that they have a goal in mind, then you could give Kirk a little more credit in saying, okay, well, he's stopping a threat that then would end in this result. Right now, the only threat is that you have more people who are going to be unwillingly happy, you know, and stop progress and stop human achievement, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, and again, you can make an argument either way, as Ken and I did on our show. But yeah, if you introduce that element, then you have a whole other reason for Kirk's actions and for him to just make it stop.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about this side of paradise for an hour, so let's wrap up with our final thoughts. So, Kate, why don't you kick us off in final thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I'm a fairly new viewer of the original series, and this is an episode that stood out to me because I think it just offers so much in terms of character development. And for me, both Spock and Kirk, we see quite a bit of who they are, and I love that. I love the fun side of this episode. And I love that it opens up so many philosophical issues. And I think the fact that it is such a grey area as to whether the spores have intelligence or not makes it even better, because then we get to question the choice that we make as individuals and how that impacts ourselves versus how that impacts the society we live in. And so what on the surface seems like just a bit of fun with Spock hanging from trees and talking about dragons and rainbows, you know, it can be taken as so much more as an episode as a whole. And that's why I love this episode.
I think that this is one of those TOS episodes that everyone should see. I think that it's got a good balance of the humor. We've got the action when they're all trying to release the spores. We've got the character development. We've got romance, and we've got stories that only the 60s could bring us with, you know, real flower children. And so I think it's a really well-rounded TOS episode, and the deeper things that we've got into only make it that much better. I mean, the fact that we're still talking about it and debating parts of it, you know, almost 50 years later is incredible. So I'm going to give it 9 Georgia-style mint juleps.
Great rating. How about you, John?
I think This Side of Paradise is it's almost like a happy accident. I think they probably started out with the idea of this being really simple, really clear-cut. Spores take over. They change your mind just like a drug would. We have to stop it, and let's go on to next week's story. But they ended up with something that, as you just pointed out, we're still talking about 50 years later, and we get to tear it apart and figure out if there are bigger morals, meanings, and messages to be found. It's not my favorite episode. I'm a little surprised, like I said, that we got so much feedback after talking about this one. I think there are better Star Trek episodes, and certainly there are better episodes that typify what Star Trek is all about. But it's well acted. It is, for the most part, well written. It gives us interesting insight into Spock. It gives us maybe not so interesting insight into McCoy. but for those reasons, I will give it 7 dead cows out of 10.
Excellent.
And for those that are interested, I do need to give my rating too, actually.
Yeah.
And I think today, as the only woman on the show, I'm going to give it 8¾ direct answers.
Awesome.
Oh.
Yeah, we didn't mention the sexism in this show, but that's a whole other show.
That's another hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to agree with everything that you guys said, so I'll keep mine very short. Yeah, I think, John, you make a good point that it's kind of a happy accident. It leaves a lot more open for debate, I think, than a lot of TOS episodes do, where the message is a bit more direct, whether you agree with the resolution or not. This one, possibly unintentionally, I think that a lot of it may have to do with the transition of the story from the original concept to what we ended up with, and some elements maybe not being executed all that well in the final story left a lot of kind of ambiguity as to what was going on. But it's great Star Trek, because that gives us more to talk about, more to speculate on. And again, on the Ready Room, we tend to do a lot of the what if, bigger picture, kind of general application to society. Yeah, the episode is well acted. You know, I think Shatner did an excellent job in here as Kirk. Spock's always, I guess it shows the diversity of Leonard Nimoy being able to normally play Spock as dry as he does, and then be able to just be ridiculously giddy in this episode and flip that on and off. So I really enjoy this episode. Definitely one everyone should go and watch. And I'm going to give this one 7 hard shell Samsonite suitcases.
I love it.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys, on The Ready Room. Kate, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
You can find me on Twitter, and my handle is Kate is Great Okay, and that's all one word. And I occasionally pop up on the Trek FM forums as well.
And occasionally people will hear you on Trek News and Views with Colin and on Deckhand with Colin, Tom, and Shervin.
And I'm going to be on there next week as well.
Excellent. Great. And John, where can people find you?
Sure, you can find Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast, on Twitter at Mission Log Pod, and on the internet at missionlogpodcast.com. You can also find me on my other show, DVD Geeks, which is at DVD Geeks, and dvdgeeks.tv.
Excellent. Check out both great shows. So thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, that was a really great discussion that we had with them. Like, I'm really glad that we had John and Kate and that they were able. Oh, John and Kate. John and Kate, you know, like the people with the eight kids. Never mind.
Not the same John
Not
and
the
Kate.
Same John and Kate. No. But that was great, having John and Kate to bring their perspectives in. It's always interesting when we have new guests come in because they always have a different opinion about Star Trek and about the original series.
Absolutely. And I'm glad once again we found an episode that, although it has its fun moments, of course, Spock hanging upside down from a tree branch, McCoy getting more and more Southern as the episode goes on and as those mint juleps get into him, it's still an episode where we can have a very serious discussion about messages in the original series. You know, it's easy sometimes to pick those fun ones like the Gamesters of Triskelion and just have fun the whole time, but there's a lot of serious stuff in TOS, which is what got me into Star Trek in the first place.
This is what Roddenberry intended.
This was a good choice. Exactly. Well, Drew, let's tell everyone how to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on This Side of Paradise or anything else we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose The Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. If you want to have a bigger discussion, you can go over to our new forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for The Ready Room. There's one for the original series. And you can chat with us and the other listeners about today's episode and the ideas we talked about. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, where we play a lot of different games these days with our followers there. Fill in the blank, rewrite the script in one word, all kinds of fun stuff. And, of course, you can find us on Twitter under username TrekFM. And, Drew, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, if they want to find me personally, they can find me on Twitter at 005. And they can find, well, not really find me on my blog, but 005.wordpress.com. I update it with my other podcasting things, events that I've done, just so you can keep track of me. For my friends who don't know where I was the year I left Facebook.
Right. And are you still working on the Star Wars project as well?
Yeah, I'm still working on Star Wars Revisited. We just revealed a clip as a thank you for donations that revealed the computer-generated Scout Walkers that I've known about for 2.5 years now and have not been able to talk about at all. It's been really, really hard.
It is your destiny.
I bet. That's great. So where can people find that if they want to check
They can find that at swrevisited.wordpress.com, where I run the site there. You can find all the videos and news. It'll come out this year sometime.
Great. We'll keep our eyes open. And if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that username. And you can find me elsewhere on the network here each week doing The Orb and Literary Treks, both with Matthew Rushing. The Orb, we talk all about Deep Space Nine in depth, very serious discussions. And Literary Treks is all about Star Trek books and comics. And we have a lot of authors on for interviews, you know, David Mack, Dayton Ward, Una McCormick, so many authors on, and it's really fascinating if you're into the expanded universe. So check those out as well. We'd also like to invite you to take advantage of that special offer from our sponsor, Squarespace. Go over to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4, that's TREK4 for April, to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts for what I promise you is absolutely the best platform for building blogs or websites or now even stores with the commerce feature. You'll absolutely love it at squarespace.com/trek. Well, Drew, I'm going to wander off. You know, I haven't really been sleeping that well. I need to relax a little bit. I'm going to go lay in the grass, see what kind of animal shapes I can find in the clouds. And if I'm lucky, I might even see an Andorian.
Well, Chris, it's time to stick a Berthold Ray in it because the Ready Room is done.